everybody have a handout? We're passing out the handouts. If you don't have one, raise your hand and they'll bring you one. Some of you have seen parts of this handout 2.5 years ago and you still remember it. That's good. It is quite memorable. All right, now last week we had trouble with the projector, and so we got that straightened out, and the boys in the sound booth knew what was wrong, and so we got that fixed. I hope we don't have any more trouble like that again. When we left you last time, we were talking about the three major Bible manuscripts from apparently from the 3rd or 4th century after Christ. Now that's several hundred years later, of course. And those three, we can there we go. Those three are seen here in comparison. We're not looking at the same scriptures in each case. We'll do that some later on. But just to give you an idea of what they look like, in the upper left is the Sinaiticus, found in southern Sinai. We talked about the finding of that last week. The one below it is the Alexandrinus, which is from Alexandria, Egypt. And the one on the right is the Vaticanus, which also apparently came from a place in Egypt. Most of these manuscripts survived in Egypt because it's so dry and warm. The bugs that eat parchment apparently don't do too well in that kind of an environment. And so we have surviving manuscripts there. These are what we call the big three among the manuscripts of the Bible. Now, we're going to talk about manuscripts of the Gospels, not the whole Bible. But these three contain some Old Testament, some almost an intact Septuagint. It's all in Greek. And so we have that, which we talked about a couple of weeks ago, the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, and then most of the New Testament as well. The one from Sinai does not, it's the Alexandrinus, excuse me, the one from Alexandria does not contain the first part of the book of Matthew. That has been lost for some reason. But most of the Gospels are intact in these, and so here you can kind of compare the writing of them. They're very similar. The one on the lower left contains some separation of paragraphs, as it were. When the topics changed, the scribe put in a capital letter in the left margin to indicate that. You notice here there's a gap, and so the new thoughts actually begin here, but when he gets to the left over here, he puts in a large letter S. And so the capital C represents an S in the Greek. And so you have that, and some of that sort of thing in the Sinaiticus, and also some little marks in between lines where the scribes have made some notes. And then the interesting thing about Vaticanus, he's good about, when he gets to the right-hand margin over here, he wants it to be pretty even. He's got a letter left over, he puts in a little bitty letter. But it's he's trying to be neat, I guess. But there are no gaps in it to speak of here. And so you don't have a real good indication when the thought changes, except there are marks put here. This is the introduction to the book of Luke. And this is Luke's expression of how he did his research. And from here on down is the beginning of his narration of the birth narrative of Jesus. Of John the Baptist to start with. Okay, so we didn't get a look at comparing the manuscripts. You look at that and you say, well, I can't understand all of that. But we're going to show you some things you can understand Now, here is the subject of our discussion in here for the next couple of months. We're looking at the Codex W, we'll call it, the one that was that's in the Smithsonian Institution, belongs to Mr. Freer, who bought it about 100 years ago. It got stuck in a drawer in the Smithsonian, and nobody paid much attention to it after its original discovery. And we'll talk about the details of that this morning. But you can see that the lettering is the same as we have here, but it looks a lot more crude than, say, the Vaticanus, which looks to me to be done by a professional scribe who was being very careful to keep everything upright and uniform and equal. And you don't have all of that care over here. This is a bit more smeared in the case of the Washington Monument, Washington manuscripts. The Washington Codex was discovered in Egypt in about 1906 by a treasure hunter and sold to C.L. Freer. We'll talk about how that transaction came to be in a minute. He put it in his collection of manuscripts in the Smithsonian Museum. He has some others from the Septuagint, some of the New Testament, besides the Gospels. So, this turns out to be Luke 1:1-5, and that's what this is. So here we have the very same material. This is in a single column per page, like this. And so it's not divided into columns as it was in the Vaticanus, where you have several columns to a page. It's all spread across the page in the case of the Washington manuscript. Now, if you're familiar with Luke, you know the material that we're talking about here. And that's the interesting thing about this. Even though it's in Greek, you have the translation in the Bible. So you have a leg up on understanding this because you know what the message is all about there. It isn't a word-for-word translation, of course, and so that makes it a bit difficult. You need to know a little bit about the Greek language in order to be able to find specific words. But there are some words in the Greek manuscript that you can recognize. You already know about names as they come up. Names and translation from Greek to English generally are transliterated rather than being interpreted in any way. Now, the names have meaning, and those of you who have looked up the meaning of the name Mary or Beth or whatever your name is know that they have some meaning behind them, but the translators didn't bother to give you that information. That wouldn't be useful to you. They just convert the Greek directly into English by transliteration. And so we have here in the introduction to Luke's Gospel, in this section down here, we have a bunch of names. And if you know what the names are, and you do because you have the book of Luke in your Bible, then you can look and see what names you're looking for. And so we can pick those names out. Pardon me? Oh, yeah, I have some more handouts here. We'll get you one. The names you can recognize. Now, he talks about the research that he did, and then he talks about, oh, excellent Theophilus, to whom he's addressing the book of Luke. And so here is Theophilus's name spread across two lines here. He doesn't hesitate to just divide it. And so here's Theophile, and so that's Theophilus. When he gets down here to the birth, he talks about it happened in the time of HERO D, Herod, and here's Basileia, which means the kingdom. And so it's Herod the king. Now, he's going to talk about a priest. What the priest who was the father of John the Baptist, what's his name? Zechariah, right? And so here it is, Z-A, it's an X because an X is a hard C, Z-A-C-A-R-I-A. And there's a little S on the end of it because the names sometimes have endings that indicate how they're used in the sentence, in the grammar. So here's Zacharias' name. He goes on to say he had a wife who was of the descendants of A-A-R-O-N. This omega is an O. And who is that? That's a daughter of Aaron, which meant that she was of the tribe of Levi. That's right. And so, so her name was, he goes on and says N-O-M-A, which is a name. Her name was E-L-E-I-S-A-B-E-T, which is what? Elizabeth, sure. And so once you get the hang of that, and you've got the English translation in your own Bible, you can find these names. Now, they're up here, too. And so here are the same names in the Washington document. So here's Theophilus here. Here's Herod the king. Here is Zechariah. Here's Aaron. And here's Elizabeth. But there's a difference you'll note here in the spelling. E-L-E-I-A or E-L-E-I-S-A-B-E-T. And here it is E-L-I-S-A-B-E-T. By the time the Vaticanus document was transcribed, the scribes were correcting the spelling of names and words that had a single I in it in the earlier Greek and making it an EI, what's called a diphthong. They put two vowels together to go with the current usage of these names at the time the Vaticanus was. And this is done not only in names but also in a lot of other words. And that's an indication that the Vaticanus came after the Washington manuscript. And so here's just those two names. And also we talked about the Septuagint. And here's a copy on papyrus of the a passage from Numbers, which is part of the Torah. And we mentioned that once before. And I think you've seen this column of writing. It's just a fragment. But the writing looks very much like the writing that we see in the Washington manuscript. And we'll talk about that some more as we compare. Now, when we get to the discovery of this, and we're going to talk about that this morning and the rest of the time that we have, the discovery of this codex, this book, and all of the pictures, I'm obligated to tell you that all of the pictures of the manuscripts come from the internet, from a site called the CSNTM, the Center for the Study of New Testament Manuscripts. And if you go to that, if you Google that, for example, you don't have to know its address, and you'll get this long list of all the manuscripts that they have available for you to study if you're doing a doctoral dissertation or something on some of this material. But it's available to anybody. So you can go see it. But some of the manuscripts, the owner doesn't allow them to put it online. But if you go to the site, and it's in Texas, surprise, surprise, it's up, as you see here, near Dallas at Plano. And so you can go there and look at some of these manuscripts, and they have them collected at this center. So you can look at them if you want to do the studies. We're not going to worry about that so much. I want to remind you of the theorem that we're discussing in here, and that is the concept that all of the manuscripts date from the 3rd and 4th centuries at the earliest, and so it's several hundred years after the life of Christ, and so it must have been transmitted orally down to that period of time before Christians wrote it down in the form that we call the Gospels. If the Gospels are that old, then you might suspect that maybe some of it is mythology, finally written down with embellishment and myth. And so the conclusion of the atheist, and even some agnostics, is that you can't trust the Gospels because they're transmitted orally for 200 or 300 years. And if you went about to try to write some definitive works about the Revolutionary War a couple hundred years ago, who said what, and so on, you'd be hard-pressed to come up with any discussion like we see in the Gospels. And so if it were true that the oldest manuscripts available, that it was never written down until the 200 or 300 or 400 after the birth of Christ, then, of course, you would have a valid argument that it might not could be trusted. But we think we do have manuscripts. And I'm going to show you some information about these Washington documents. We'll just call it Codex W. That indicate that they are first century documents. Now, the evidence is, by and large, circumstantial, in the sense that you may could think up an alternate argument to say that they're not what they appear to be. But you also know that you can be convicted in a court of law if there's enough circumstantial evidence that all points to the same conclusion. And so we're not going to claim that any of this actually proves the case, but it supports the case. And that's all that we need to claim about it, as a matter of fact. So let's talk about how it was found. Incidentally, Peter indicates that the skeptic's theorem isn't true, that eyewitnesses recorded the material that is the basis of the gospel. We were eyewitnesses of His Majesty. Now, we do know that in the case of the Jewish temple, that there were original documents that were copied periodically, maybe every 100 years, as they wore out, and new ones were formed. And some of them may have lasted several hundred years. We don't really know for sure how long they lasted. But when we talked about the work of the scribe, you remember we said when the document got old and torn and dirty and that sort of thing, then they buried it ceremonially like they were burying a human being. But they copied it first and then buried the old one, and they had a new one which would last for quite a while, and it was well cared for in the temple. But after the destruction of the temple and the Jews came back to Jerusalem after the 70 years of Babylonian captivity, then some of these documents made their way into the meeting houses of the Jews. And those places, what are they called? Where they met? The synagogues, yeah. The synagogues had copies of the books of the Old Testament. We saw that in the case of Jesus, who sat down, who stood up to read in the synagogue in Nazareth, unrolled a scroll, found the place, read the material he wanted to talk about, and then rolled it back up. So they had a scroll in the synagogue. And so this material was being copied. It was being copied both in Hebrew, which the scribes were using to teach the children about the Bible, the Old Testament. And then also it was used in the synagogues for teaching on the weekends when the adults met. Well, but in the New Testament times, it would appear that there were source documents, what we call a primary copy, that was copied, and some of these copies were kept to be recopied later on. And so we have here sequential serial copying versus clustering, the place in which these materials were copied is called a scriptorium. They would make many copies all the time and distribute those copies, particularly in the New Testament when they were taking the gospel to the whole world. And they did it in the language of the Greeks because that was the universal language of the time. Okay. Now, we talked about the apparent ages of these. The one that the scholars think is the oldest is the Vaticanus. Sinaiticus is close. Those are both in the 300s. But that's a long time after the life of Christ. And the rest of these, Alexandrinus and the others, I tend to think that the Alexandrinus is actually older than 500 A.D., but I'm not a scholar to assign a number to those manuscripts. But this is what they have concluded largely from a study of the language, the shape of the letters, what we call paleography, and where they were found and how the different books relate to each other. For example, we talked last time that although Alexandrinus and Sinaiticus are very similar, they can't have come from a single, have been copied from a single source because they contain some differences. So anyway, the copyists were working all through this time, but we're going to talk about particularly the Codex W. Now, it was assigned a date of around 400 to 500 A.D., but that was done 100 years ago with very simple criteria, not studied, I think, adequately. And there are other scholars who also are beginning to realize that the ones who looked at it didn't give it a close enough examination. All right. Here's how it happened. And there's a book that we'll talk about in a minute that describes all of this by Lee Woodard, and he's mentioned down here at the bottom. So the manuscripts were found by a native treasure hunter in Egypt, south of Cairo, about 1906 A.D., and they were then sold to an Egyptian antiquities dealer, Sheikh Ali Arabi. Now, there is a provenance for these documents, and Arabi knows who the treasure hunter was, but he won't reveal it. Well, I doubt if he could reveal it now. This was 100 years ago. He's not alive anymore. But he didn't want to reveal who the treasure hunter was because what he was doing was illegal, hunting for treasure. Not supposed to do that. They go out in the middle of the night and dig a ditch and look for stuff, anything they find. And the sands of Egypt are full of stuff. I mean, that civilization's been there 5,000 years, so it's got all kinds of stuff buried in the sand. And so treasure hunters can make a living doing that. His name is not known, but that's the only thing about this that isn't known. Where he did his digging and everything is pretty well known, and we'll look at that. The codex was reported to have been found buried in the sand of the ruins of an ancient Christian church. Mr. Arabi sold the codex to an American, Mr. Charles Lane Freer. Incidentally, after he had offered it to museums and libraries in Europe, but they decided it wasn't worthwhile. It's only the Gospels. It's not the whole Bible. I guess they were turned off because these other manuscripts, the big three manuscripts, included both Old and New Testament, and this was just a small portion. So they neglected to buy it. But it was sold to Charles Lang Freer, who then put them in the Freer Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C., in 1906. The price was $7,750, That includes the purchase of a couple of Septuagint manuscripts, Greek manuscripts of the Torah, of parts of the Torah, and some other New Testament material as well. So, now that was over 100 years ago. The manuscripts were examined by a scholar, Professor Henry A. Sanders of the University of Michigan. Now, Sanders was well qualified to do this, who by the Greek writing style, he estimated that the codex dated to the late 4th or early 5th century. The book was put in a drawer in the Freer Gallery and left for about 75 years until Lee Woodard asked to study it. This is Lee Woodard. He lives in Oklahoma. He's a preacher in the Christian church. And he also was involved in the deciphering of something called the LaSalle Monument in Sallisaw, Oklahoma. He was good at runestone determinations and that sort of thing. And people had wondered about this particular monument, but he showed that it was actually the explorer LaSalle who had made his way into eastern Oklahoma and left those monuments. So I had some communication with him, and Lee has sent me some materials, and so we communicated for quite a while earlier on in the 2000s. Now, he began to work on this about 1985. This is the place where the treasure hunter dug the manuscripts up. It's a sandy spot southwest of Cairo, and there are old buildings there that apparently were Christian churches in the early centuries that have fallen into decay, as all of these things do, made out of mud brick, some of them made out of stone. Medinet Demet is the supposed place where Codex W was unearthed, in ruins of old communal or monastic, very early Christian church ruins. And they date back to to the 300s or even to the first century. You can't tell when those ruins were in use, but at least they're very ancient. And Philo of Alexandria apparently described these communes in the first century A.D. in Egypt. And this is from the personal papers of Charles L. Freer. It's a copy of some material in his. In Lee Woodard's book, he puts copies of all of these documents. He also has the bill of sale and all of the provenance involved in establishing how these documents were discovered. This is what they look like. This is the actual size of the document. You can see that it's most of these. This is the first page of the Book of Mark. It contains three edges that are pretty ragged and one edge that's pretty straight, because this edge was the attachment to the choir. Remember, we talked about what choirs were, folded pages that were then bound into the book. Now, because it was folded, it was protected, didn't decay as much as the other edges did. Now, Dr. Sanders, took the choirs apart. He made lists of how many pages per choir and how many choirs per document, per book of the Bible, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. That's all we're talking about here. And then he numbered the pages and found that there were six pages missing, three leaves that had been taken out of the document, two of them from the book of John, and one, I think, was from the book of Mark, that had been taken from the document by the finder and distributed to the antiquities dealers as sort of a piece of advertising so they could evaluate what he had and decide how much it was worth and whether to buy it. And, of course, Mr. Arabi did buy that. But the, but the choirs have been taken apart. On the first pages of the document, they're written on two sides, of course. This is just a facsimile. But on the first pages, there are black spots that apparently were bits of oil droplets from an oil lamp that fell upon the document when it was lying open, being examined at night. Lee Woodard thinks that it's because of the persecution in the period of the Nero. The Emperor Nero launched a vendetta against the Christians, and particularly in Rome and Europe, but also even in Egypt. And so to have one of these documents was a danger. And so he thinks they brought them out at night to show to visiting dignitaries. And they would look at the first page and also the last page. And those are the only pages that have those spots on them, which had a letter or two, but we know what's there. Now, the whole material was wrapped in cloth and animal skins and buried in the sand. So it survived a couple of thousand years because really it was protected. There wasn't any rain to speak of. It didn't penetrate the sand to the depth at which it was buried. And it may have been buried as a Jewish custom, as a worn-out document. It may have been buried to hide it from the authorities. No one knows which of those is true. So here's what each page looks like. You look at the pages of it, they're all very similar in that respect, except for what's written on them, of course, which is unique in each case. At the very top, the title says, The Gospel According to Mark. Very simple titles. Many of the documents that we saw, of later manuscripts, have fancy drawings on them and fancy letters and things of that. You don't see that much in this at all. So this is the start of Mark. And I remind you from time to time of the alphabet in the Greek, which includes only a half a dozen letters that are difficult for us. When you see a capital H, it often includes the vowel E. It was used as a vowel, as a matter of fact, and that's part of our language even today when we don't pronounce the H in words like honor and hour and so on. It's left over from the Greek usage of this as a vowel. This O, omega, is like our O. The ones that are confusing are P and R, because R looks like a P and P looks like three sides to a box. But you can pick those up. And there are these two unusual looking ones here. This vertical line got moved over in the making of the document. But these are easy to pick out because this vertical line is often very tall, both in a psi and a phi. And those of you who belong to a college fraternity or sorority learn some Greek names. Greek letters, didn't you? So that's what we're talking about here. The other one that is a TH here, which is often used. Theo is the name of God, and so it's used in one of those abbreviations, and it's easy to pick out. Okay, enough of that. We'll see more of that later on. This letter is quite different, though. There's no C in this except for Chi, which is an X, and it's like a hard C. The G, it looks like a small letter R. Okay, here's a close-up look at the opening verses of Mark. And it says up here, the gospel. Kata means after or according to. And here's Mark's name, M-A-R-K-O-N. It's Sometimes it's M-A-R-K-O-S. Depends on how it's used in a sentence. But John Mark is his name. John is his Hebrew name, and Mark is actually a Roman name. And so he has a double name like that because he evidently was involved in international, well, he traveled as a missionary. And so he had both names that he could use. And so it says, beginning of the, and then it's the gospel, and here is Jesus Christ, and here, this means Son of, and here is God. These words, I remind you, were abbreviated. They were not spelled out. It was a Jewish custom not to write out the name of God, and also indicating that Jesus was considered to be God. And so the sacred names, or the noma sacra, were all abbreviated, as you see here. And you'll see another name down here that's done that same way, a KU. Now the letter that looks like a Y is actually a capital U. And so a KU with a line above it is the word Lord. And so that was also abbreviated. Now this is not an abbreviation. This is the way in which the letter Z was written. Or the letter, I forget, I guess that's an X, a Zai. Here, these are all spots. And here's Lord again. So you can pick out, some things in the document, and by looking at your copy of the translation, you can figure out what you're looking at. Now, he starts out, if you look at the Gospel according to Mark, he starts out early on with a prophecy about the coming of the Messiah. And he quotes Malachi first, Malachi 3. I'll send my servant before you come. You remember that kind of thing? And that's up here. But he says, according to the prophets, he does not say, as most translations say, according to Isaiah the prophet. And that has been criticized sometimes because part of it, he starts out, he's actually talking about Malachi. A forerunner. He quotes a whole lot more, and this is one major difference between this copy of Mark and all of the rest of them. He quotes not just one or two verses. He quotes five or six verses all the way through this whole period. He's quoting a whole lot more of Isaiah than we have in our current Bible. Someone decided that it was only necessary to put just the first couple of lines, and that was sufficient. I don't know where that transition happened. So this is the same thing. I want to point out one more thing about it. He comes down here, concluding his introduction, and then it says, then came, here is the name of John, I Omega A-N-N-E-S. And so here comes John, and what was John's other part of his name? The Baptist. And so the word baptize and Baptist was not translated when the Greek was turned into English. So you can pick out Baptist here where the red arrow is. B-A-P-T-I-Z-O. Baptizo. John Baptist. And he was preaching, it says, here's the same word again. B-A-P-T-I-S-M-A, a baptism of repentance for the forgiveness of sin. And so that's, this word, M-E-T-A-N-O-I, metanoi, or metanoi, is the word for repentance. And you might have heard Ken talk about that sometime in the past. And there it is, it's in these documents. And it kind of sends a chill down your spine to think that was penned you've got a picture of what was penned by the scribe. And here are these letters that have the vertical line between them. They make a kind of a pattern that you can see when you're looking over the page. Now, on your handout today, you have the pictures of the cover of the manuscript. And here it is in actual size. This is a facsimile. It's not the original, okay? But it looked just like this. It had a small number of holes on the left side of it here where the binding threads pass through to hold the cover to the document itself. And then we have, and so you can see that whoever it was on the right didn't survive the handling very well. It had been handled and opened and so on many times, and apparently their thumbs or fingers, they didn't know to wear white gloves. And so that got, as they opened it, apparently it got worn away. The back cover, however, survived in pretty good shape. And, of course, it was on the other side and protected somewhat, because when they were looking at it, they were opening it here, and that was face down on the table. And the pages were in between, bound in between in such a way that they could be taken out to be copied. Each of the four books was separate, a separate set of quires for each of the four Gospels. The book could be taken apart and copies made. Now, you'll notice one thing about them. We don't know about John, but you can see that their hands were covered by their robe, and in each case, they're carrying a copy of the book that they wrote. So there's no doubt that the one who drew the picture intended for us to understand that these were the authors of the four Gospels, except for Mark, whose hand is uncovered. And over on the right-hand side is M-A-R-K-O-S written in the dark painting, and that spells Mark. So we know this is Mark, and Mark is missing the end of his middle finger on his right hand. There's a story that goes with that. Hippolycus wrote in the 2nd century that Mark had a nickname of Stubby Finger, and that apparently the story is Mark, who was Barnabas's cousin, and we know Barnabas was a Levite, so Mark would have been a Levite too, that Mark, the story was that Mark had self-mutilated himself, cut off the tip of his middle finger, so he would no longer qualify to serve as a priest in Jerusalem. He couldn't be conscripted into service if he had a defect, and that was his defect. And it shows, apparently, the one who drew the picture intended to show his hand, and here's apparently the Gospel according to Mark. Now, there's a gold circle behind each face, and many people have interpreted that as a halo or something, but really it was a way in which the painter could show the details of the face of the individual without it fading into the darker background. They all had pointed beards, which were characteristic of the Jewish traditions. So we'll stop there. The implication is somebody drew these pictures to show us what those four authors looked like. It's sufficient, I think, to indicate that the pictures were made while these men were still alive. And Ken has a question or a comment.
We forget what the overall picture is.
is just like what was in these manuscripts. Now, there's a lot more evidence. We're taking it slowly, a little bit at a time, and we'll summarize the whole thing in a couple of months. And I think you'll find that there's a lot of evidence that shows that these are first century manuscripts, probably put together and copied in the presence of the author. We'll talk more about that in coming weeks. Thank you very much.